All right. So each month, George and I get together and we talk about a different business topic, a different entrepreneur. George, it's good to be back with you.
Thanks for having me.
So last month, we spoke about Dyson and we spoke about that journey. Today, I want to talk about something a little bit different. I want to talk about Les Schwab, Pride and Performance. It's an old school American classic business book, old school classic American entrepreneur. Maybe a bit of background as to who this entrepreneur is and the business he was in.
Yeah, so Les Schwab was a gentleman, I think, born in the 30s, ended up going serving in World War II, started a tire business. Was it, actually, and just to backtrack, he was an orphan at the age of 15.
Mm.
Right? Ended up working for a newspaper and then bought a car tire franchise.
Old school business,
old
right?
School, very, very old school. But it was still quite... It was a burgeoning business back in that day, and he did a very American thing. He mortgaged his house, took money out on his life insurance, and borrowed as well. I believe it was $11,000 for this franchise, and then later on he changed the name to his, what is it now? It's a 75 years later or more. We're talking about the story of this gentleman.
It's very interesting because a lot of entrepreneurs that went or grew up during the Great Depression or were kind of like on the cusp of adulthood, young children around the Great Depression, they saw things that they later used as ammunition to build great businesses in the 60s, 70s and 80s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there was you know, America at that time, especially after the Great Depression and especially after the Second World War, there was this huge emphasis around, I mean, there was the GI Bill and there was a lot of entrepreneurship and so forth, you know, and America was really the standout, right, globally with regards to business and entrepreneurship. And this is one of many stories out there of how they're successful. And also the level of risk that Les Schwab actually took, a wife, 11-year-old son, and expecting another one, mortgaging everything to start this. And it's really, I admire those kinds of stories, especially being able to throw yourself into the deep end.
They're great entrepreneurs to learn from in a time before entrepreneurship became glorified through social media. And, you know, everyone calls themselves an entrepreneur now, but really entrepreneurship in the old school sense was these guys that went out into frontier. I mean, the tire business sounds very trivial today, but back then, you know, car adoption was just at the cusp.
Absolutely. You know, there was even though Henry Ford, innovated the production model and so forth, it was very much a luxury.
Mm.
You know, and so to think about it, to invest in it, and to make it his life's work is quite admirable.
Jeff Bezos says something interesting. He says, I didn't have to build the internet. I came and built on top of the internet. Yeah, but before me, people came and built the internet, and we forget of how important the basics are to lay the foundations to later build on top. So this kind of reminds me on that. There's five things we're going to talk about today. Customer service, nothing new, but we're going to put a different spin on it and why it's important. Employee empowerment, we're going to go a little bit deeper into that, what it actually means to not pretend like you care about your employees, but to actually empower them so that they can build your business. Ethical business practices, again, doing real things that are ethical, not pretending to do good. Community involvement, which you and I share a common interest in, and also adaptability and innovation. Let's go right from the top, George. Exceptional customer service. We kind of spoke about that in the Amazon episode and that Amazon built around exceptional customer service. But what's your kind of spin, pun intended?
Yeah.
What's your spin here with Les Schwab's story?
Well, I mean, you can see that it starts from the top. It works its way down the bottom. You know, we all talk about values and so forth, but you need to walk your values.
Yeah,
and not just talk those. And, you know, and in addition to that as well is that you not only walk them, but you also have to allocate resources to that. You know? How much do you value the customer? Right? Well, you have to show that. Right? And I think that's really, really important. But, you know, also you need to look at, you know, the size of your business, what your product or service is. You know, if you're a B2B, you know, as opposed to B2C. And I'd encourage your audience to really have a look at what they call, in from a marketing perspective, the buyer's behavior.
Mm.
And that buyer's behavior will dictate how you actually approach your customers. But also, you know, understanding the central tenet in all this is that you're actually asking an individual to part ways with their money for something that you're offering.
Mm.
So how is it not that you'd be absolutely obsessed,
mm-hmm.
right, with all their needs and wants and satisfying those? If you're able to satisfy those, it makes that transfer of you giving something and then taking money out of them a lot more easier.
I don't think there's any business out there that thinks that their customer service or their customer experience isn't good.
No.
But in reality, most businesses out there don't do a good job at it. So where's the gap between what you think is good customer experience and what it is really customer experience? Where do most businesses lose between their own perception and reality?
I think talking to the customer, understanding, you know, asking your customer, what, you know, how do they feel about your product or your service? How do they feel about the whole, you know, customer journey from acknowledging your presence and all the way to making a transaction? I mean, and that comes from this school called design thinking, right? Or what we call the customer journey, right? From 0 to 10. And a lot of business owners seem to think they know what the customer wants. That's the trap. They think they know what the customer wants instead of actually going out there and asking them what it is that they want.
This is a nice glass. You should buy it.
Yeah.
I don't want to buy it. No, you should, right? It really is a nice glass. But then, you know, why don't you want to buy it and what are you actually drinking from and going deeper and finding out that George actually likes, you know, those new water bottles that everyone's holding around these days, those big chunky water bottles. To me, they look really, really silly. But as an entrepreneur, that's an example of listening and not talking at the customer, right?
Yeah, and I mean, and we do that. And, you know, sometimes our success is also, you know, the beginning of our failure.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean by that is that, you know, the only thing that doesn't really change is change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And meaning that customer preferences, customer tastes, you know, and other sort of factors in the environment are always constantly changing. So we need to be at the forefront of that and understand what our how customer preferences, customer tastes are always changing, and we moving with that as well, right? So
whether you're doing good or bad, you have to change.
Always. I mean, you know, we change our clothing depending on the seasons.
Yeah.
Right. We change our lifestyle depending on our financial situations. So from a personal perspective, we're always in a state of flux. And so should our business as well. I mean, you know, the rate of change really depends on the growth of the industry and other sorts of factors as well. You know, we're not talking about revolutionary change, but we always need to be scanning the environment, seeing what the latest trends are, the latest tastes and so forth, and moving incrementally to capture those as well.
You've got to be on your toes.
Always right. On your toes. You need to have what I like to refer as measured paranoia, right? And also keeping a very close distance between what's happening in the market and our tracking with it as well. Right? If we start to diverge away, you start to eventually see that in our sales.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, when you care and you're paranoid about your customer, you learn a lot, and it doesn't mean you'll always satisfy them.
No.
Sometimes, you know, you have to turn around and say no and design around that. But the customer and the market will always tell you. And what about someone that doesn't have enough business, right? So you could have a handful of clients and you want more, or you're doing X amount of business and you want more, and your customer feedback loop is minimal.
Yeah.
How can you use marketplace feedback to then go and grow off?
Well, you know, one way of doing that is to actually look at, and I mean, we've got, there's so many resources out there. And like I said, it's very contextual. It depends on your organization, depends on the industry, depends on your size. But one way, if you're a restaurant business and you want to know what not to do, have a look at the restaurants around your area and look at what the bad reviews say.
Mm.
Right? That's not what you do, right?
Yep.
You know, so there's plenty of innovative ways of finding customer feedback. Might not relate to you specifically, but relate to your competitors.
One of the things I love about digital marketing, and you know, I am very heavy on digital marketing and our businesses are built on digital marketing. I love digital marketing because it gives you live information on what's not working.
Yep.
And most of the things that we do in digital marketing don't work.
Yeah.
But we learn a lot more from the things that don't work than the things that work.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of times things work and we're like, wow, I've got no reason why this is working, but let's run with it.
Yeah.
But then when you put messages out there and your engagement is really low, there's so much more power in that, in understanding what the marketplace wants.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I like to say that that research and analysis is not to guide us on what to do, but to reduce the uncertainty of our path.
Yeah. Right. That's a good one.
Yeah. So that's and that's why we do that.
Cool. So Les Schwab is unique in that to grow the business and to scale it at a time in corporate America where everyone was kind of like working your 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
The middle class was quite strong. It was difficult to attract people to a growing business and grow. So they implemented a really interesting employee empowerment model where they'd bring employees in, make them business owners,
yeah,
and then get them to run and grow the businesses, right?
Yeah, and I mean that's an excellent way of providing ownership from people and increasing responsibility, and it's also a great way to grow your business, right? I mean, it's kind of like a franchise model, right?
Well, that's where franchising came from,
yeah, right. So you do that, you empower people, you give them the necessary resources, they take ownership. They get responsibility, and then you get the growth that you're after. However, you know, much of this also requires, you know, a dedication from the top. You're empowering these people to go out there and build your business and your brand as well. So it requires, again, you know, it requires a very top-down approach to it. Right?
Yeah, one of the things that I've learned myself is that there's different phases of business life. Some people are really good at building businesses.
Yeah.
Some people are really good at running businesses. And usually those that build businesses are not good at running businesses. And those that are great at running businesses are not good at building, starting from scratch.
Yeah.
So there's something beautiful there where, you know, I can come and build something for you.
Yeah.
I can hand over something that I don't want to run or I'll find difficult in running, and then you'll be really successful in running that, right?
Yeah. Look, and that's an excellent point you made, and a very good example of that was Google bringing on Eric Schmidt, right? So the founders had done a very good job getting it to a certain level. However, you bring in an experienced CEO. A proper CEO who comes in, and we can talk about this in probably another podcast, but there is a gentleman by the name of Greiner who in 1969 came out with some academic research on called the five phases of growth, and he talks about what's required to start a business and then eventually what the problem becomes, and he talks about all these different phases of business, right, and the capabilities required at each step and then the problem that those capabilities produce as you get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I've definitely felt that myself. You know, I've come to the realization that my job at the beginning was to do everything.
Yeah.
And then my job changes to actually find excellent people to do the things that I'm not good at doing. And then, being around, sticking around and then changing and evolving. I think a lot of entrepreneurs, particularly small to medium business owners, they struggle to scale something that they started. They've done an excellent job, but they've sucked because they haven't been able to step back and have that self-realization that I actually suck as a CEO, for example.
And it's what a shot to the ego that is.
Yeah.
Right? How could I?
Someone else is going to come in and run my business and tell me what to do.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I mean, especially if you're a serial entrepreneur.
Yeah.
However, but the real skill is having that ability to have a very tough conversation with yourself and say, well, you know, what's more important? Is it my ego or is it the success of this business?
Exactly.
You know, and that's the real, you know, that's the question you ask the mirror.
Yeah.
And so if it is about your ego, then, you know, there's your recipe for disaster, right? However, if you are, if you're able to detach yourself from that and so and really have that honest conversation and say, you know what, this is my skill set. I'm very, very good at doing this, right? I still have ownership in the business. I still have some form of engagement with it, but I know it's time for me to kind of let it go, right?
You see, around this, I'm going to call it the boomer generation that built these businesses up and they implemented these models. We also see it here in Australia. For example, Harvey Norman is built around the franchise model. It's more of an incentive structure.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these businesses have grown in that way. And then entrepreneurship sort of, franchising came out and was an extension of that. And we've now gone to the point where, you know, you run a business by yourself and you kind of use all these tools and you hack, but there's something beautiful to playing a team and scaling. A lot of the things that have grown a lot have scaled around this employee empowerment model.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that employee empowerment model is a very, very powerful tool when done right.
Mm.
And we also need to understand the stages of employees and employees. So, you know, we look at financial satisfaction at first. However, you know, financial satisfaction for people has a diminishing return, you know, around $200,000 to $300,000. You know, and once we start to reach that level, especially when we get into our mid-30s, you know, we start to look at, you know, role fulfillment. You know, is the role fulfilling? Am I making, you know, is it meaningful to me? Am I sufficing my intellectual curiosity or my intellectual capabilities in this role that I'm doing? And then lastly, as we start to fulfill that, so we have financial, we have the intrinsic, and then as we get older, we start to look for that work-life balance. And you really as the CEO or as an entrepreneur, you know, you really have to be able to balance all those. And that's how you get the best out of people. So just like the stages of business that we go through, you know, individual stages of life also matter as well. And then how do we impart with that knowledge, you know, into those individuals who are up and coming within the organization? You have a lot of requisite knowledge up top, and then, you know, you've got no knowledge from the bottom.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this real balancing act, right? Almost like a pipeline of workers. So you get new ones, old ones, and then you get them through the different stages of their life, and also the different stages that the organization goes through as well.
I want to touch next on ethical considerations, and I want to use employees as a segue to customer, being ethical around your customers and your suppliers and everyone that you deal with. I remember reading, and you can probably attest to this better than I can, I remember reading a report that said there was a satisfaction survey around what people want, and Google done a satisfaction survey around the things that are most important to people's role, the happiness of an employee. And they found the single thing that their employees valued most, more than money, was the feeling that they were included in the decision-making process.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you, George, are a smart person. I'll pay you a lot of money, but I also respect and value you when I'm making changes. Not that what you're going to tell me is going to change my mind, but just by you feeling like, and also genuinely being involved, valuing you as a human being.
Well, that comes back to the fulfillment part of empowering staff. Right? So,
but that's an ethical thing, right?
Yeah,
it goes to your philosophy as a business owner.
Yeah,
that I actually treat you as a human being, and I care about the things that are important to you, not just you're here to do a job and get paid.
You know, ethical decisions make good business sense, right?
Yep.
What business owners who don't do this, you know, they step over dollars to get to cents.
Right? Yeah.
Right. In the sense that, well, yeah, you know, pulling employees out from their day-to-day role to engage with them and to bring them into the decision-making process. Yes. It might cost a little bit more in some of the processes, you know, and increase the time between, you know, idea to market. However, in the medium to longer term, you know, its return on investment is hundredfold, thousandfold, and so forth, right? Maybe it is unethical, maybe it is something to do with ethics, or maybe it's to do with, you know, CEOs also not understanding just how important it is, right, to bring in, you know, those individuals into the decision-making process and meet their needs, right, their needs for a fulfilling role, right?
One of the things I see is that there's a lot of bullshit and there's a lot of fakeness around that.
Businesses
pretending and working on things that are really silly and trivial and not really reading the room and saying, you're a professional, I want to bring you in, but then going overboard, you know, particularly – we won't get into it.
No, but there's, I'm sure everybody's got plenty of examples of that,
it's
right?
It's a fine line, right?
You
need to be able to push it to a certain point. Do enough but not do too much where it becomes condescending and it actually turns your employees off even more.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line. You know, if you try and satisfy everybody, you satisfy nobody, right?
Mm.
And I think individuals need to earn their right to sit at the desk to make those strategic decisions.
Yeah.
Right? And so that way you don't obfuscate the decision-making process. If you ask 1,000 people their idea of something in an organization, you'll get 1,000 different answers. Where do you go from that?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah, I think it just manifests kind of in weird places like, you know, Qantas putting stuff on their planes and getting involved in things and then going around and reporting a $2 billion profit and then sacking, you know, 500 staff. And it's like, you know, do you care? If you did, what are you doing? What the heck is going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, the whole corporate social responsibility movement, you know, it's great on paper, but, you know, there's a lot of exporting of hypocrisy, right? And you know, just need to be very, very mindful of that.
I think that comes down to really good leadership, and as a leader, you need to tell your community and your stakeholders what you're about.
Yeah.
You know, what your purpose is, what you're trying to do. You know, Les Rob, perfect example of empowering owners and providing great service to a necessity, which was putting tires on your car, but then creating an experience, doing the right thing, changing tires for free, patching them. You know, all this stuff, tire checks and whatever. Yeah. He's not trying to change the world.
No.
But he's trying to help you, you know, as a middle-class family, you know, have a safe car on the road and not spend too much money.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the strategy is not difficult. Strategy in and of itself should never be difficult. The execution of it is difficult, right? You know, and I mean, if you're about to shut, you know, if you're Les Schwab and it's 5 to 6 in the evening, you know, your wife's waiting for you at home for dinner, and a customer comes in with a flat tire, right?
Yeah.
What's customer service then?
Yeah.
Right? You spending the 15, 20 minutes to patch that tire and get them on board, right? Or saying, sorry, I'm closed. You know, I'm closing in 5 minutes. I need to go home.
That person's also got a family to go
absolutely,
home to.
Yeah, absolutely, right.
It's a difference between them feeding their kids that night or taking them to school and everything else. Right. So that's where the care factor comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you kind of go, well, that's the customer service, right?
It's about caring.
Is that there?
Yeah.
Right? And that's the difference between then having a customer for life, right, and then maybe having, you know, and then maybe – just maybe that guy coming back in the morning to get his tire fixed.
One of the things in our business that I look at and when I build business relationships is how people pay you. You know, when someone pays you on time, I've got some people that pay straight away.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a big respect factor because you're saying that you care about your reputation.
Yeah.
You care about me and you value the business we're doing together. When you don't pay, you can talk the world and have the best product in the world, but if you can't pay me on time and you can't communicate that to me, that also tells me a lot about your business ethics and the way you work, you know?
I mean, like I said, you need to walk the talk, right? And, you know, that old adage, actions speak louder than words, and it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know, there might be some people that might not have the best personality, but they deliver what they say they're going to deliver, as opposed to those who are softly spoken and so forth, right? And they get, you know, 30-day payment terms become 60, become 75, become so forth, right? So,
yeah.
Yep. So it's really important.
Okay, cool. Community involvement, really important, and thinking about a business's role in a community.
Yeah.
How does that fit in, and where's that line also between legit and bullshit?
Yeah, look, I think everybody has a role in the community. in much of what we talk about, you know, the general public discourse is about people's rights, but we seldom hear responsibilities as well. I think business has a responsibility.
Where does it stretch?
It stretches as far, you know. That's a difficult question to answer. And you know, it's like, how long is a piece of string?
Mm.
Right? However, it starts first and foremost. You know, charity starts at the home, right? And what I mean by that is that your first community that you need to look at is your staff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no point in going out there and you know, and championing all these social causes, you know, if you've got staff on minimum wage, right? Or you've got staff who are kind of, you know, border, you know, on the border of living in poverty. So, you know, I'd say to businesses, you know, what, you know, if you are in that, and I know that there's certain very large companies that do that, right? You know, if you're championing all these social causes, why don't you go back and have a look internally and ask your staff how they're doing?
That's one of the things I love about being an Australian, in that we've got this culture. I know it's not perfect, but we've got a culture where we care about our employees. We care about the dignity of an employee. And it goes down a slippery slope in the US where capitalism is important, but it loses itself, and to the point where, you know, you do lose dignity in your community and your employees.
Yeah, look, I think we also are an egalitarian society. We don't take ourselves too seriously, you know, unlike other places in the world. Everybody's pretty much on a first name basis, right? You know, we ride in the front seat of the car. We call each other by our first names. There's no real class structure, or there's no real power structures in Australia. However, we are sort of creeping to that. I'd like to say to those who have businesses out there, go and really have a look at your staff, right? Start with them first. You know, once they're satisfied, then you can start to look at, you know, other sorts of, community engagement programs and so forth. And, you know, start with the grassroots stuff, right? So, you know, for me, and I'm sure you probably agree with this, for me, socioeconomic is always the thing that I'm looking to.
Yeah,
to involve myself in, you know, bringing people out of poverty, bringing people from the working class up into a more, you know, a more sustainable economic situation, is something that we should all be endeavouring for, right?
Yeah,
you know. So, but as I said, go back and have a look at your own stuff first before you go out and start doing that. And this, you know, Les Schwab and the likes of that were able to do that because they had actual ownership of the company. When you have ownership, you have strategic decision-making power. Yeah, right. But if you're on an exchange somewhere and you have a CEO, you're at the beck and call of a whole bunch of CEOs and other social trends. In Australia, we have super funds.
Yeah,
who have these huge voting proxies, you know, and then they can kind of put in, you know, agendas such as ESG and this DEI stuff.
See, I think they're good. I want to work with businesses that have a stance on things.
Yeah.
But be upfront, be transparent, and be flexible to take counter views.
Yeah.
Don't get hostile. If you want to stand up for something you believe in, fantastic. I'd rather you tell me who you are and what you believe. I will respect you more, even if I disagree with that view.
Yeah.
Tell me where you stand and I respect you.
You know, I just don't like the hypocrisy in it, or where we're talking about, you know, cultural matters or you know, all the other sorts of social causes and so forth, yet you have a workforce that is on minimum wage and is striking, right?
Yeah.
and there are, you know, there's multiple, you know, there's multiple issues around the conditions and so forth that they're working under. Yeah, that's where I kind of really draw the line.
Well, I think that's what blew up for Woolworths recently.
Yeah.
You know, coming out, and it's great if you want to have a view on certain things. We as a country, you know, always shape our views and we're progressive. But if you treat your customers like crap, and if you're price gouging, and if you treat your employees like crap, hang on, you'll get caught out.
Well, you know, the supermarkets are an interesting case because what they've managed to do over the years is to really kind of strangle their suppliers, right? I mean, you know, if you look at their conduct, I mean, it's anything but ethical.
It's a cartel.
It's basically, yeah, it is. And, you know, and we as consumers are stuck choosing between one or the other with a few marginal players, and they've basically created, you know, they've basically created this monopoly between the, or an oligopoly between the two.
Yeah, and I think ultimately we'll come at their demise because, you know, what history has shown us is every time there's been a corporation that has gouged and slugged everyone, the market's been innovative enough. So, you know, newspapers used to dominate advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they got smashed by the internet, and rightly so, because they used to rip a lot of businesses off. Today we have digital marketing, and you know, those things will change. Hopefully there'll be innovation in the food, the way we eat our food and the way we buy our groceries. I'm sure there will be. Any final comments before we wrap, George?
What we need to do when we're looking at, you know, going back to what we were talking about with regards to customer service, we need to look at, you know, the dichotomy between tradition and innovation, right? We have to ask ourselves what remains the same in what it is that we do and what changes. You know, the notion of customer service doesn't change at all.
That's a tradition?
That's traditional.
Good old-fashioned
customer service. Good old-fashioned customer service. However, its modality changes. Right? In the traditional side of things, we would be upfront. We'd be talking to our customers. We'd be engaging with them. But now with technology and so forth, you know, we have a you know, different modality, especially with the Internet of Things and so forth. So, you know, for all businesses, really kind of, you know, jot down what's remained the same and what's changing. And that'll give you a window into how you could build and shape your customer service.
I'll put you on a spot, and I know we haven't put this in our notes, but what's a brand that you think does that well? Or who's a brand that you work with, a business that you work with, that you say, you know what, I'm actually happy at the standard that you're setting? Does anyone come to mind?
Not really. You know, you have put me on the spot. I think there's many examples out there, right? I can't find one I can think of.
That's all right. That's fair enough.
But maybe I can put it in the comment section.
We'll pick up on it next time.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And we'll start our next podcast with that.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.